It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new state law regulating the sale of e-cigarettes went into effect at the beginning of this month. And as it did, a Wisconsin trade group brought a suit against the state revenue department over the new law in federal court. The law bans the sale of vape products not approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Retailers that fail to comply could be fined up to $1,000 a day. The group that is suing and representing dozens of vape shops is called Wisconsinites for Alternatives to Smoking and Tobacco, or WiscoFast. Tyler Hall is president of WiscoFast, and he's here to explain his group's stance on the new law. Tyler, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Can you explain why your group is against banning the sale of non-FDA-approved vaping products?
Well, we are against banning it, of course. And yes, we are. We formed earlier this year. We're a group of about 75 Wisconsin vape shop owners and just industry professionals. Myself, I've been in the business for, you know, over a decade, and I've seen, you know, thousands and thousands of Wisconsinites quit smoking regular traditional cigarettes through vaping. And that right of Wisconsinites is being taken away by the state. So we formed to protect that.
And according to this FDA document I'm looking at from this month, the agency has authorized the sales of 39 different e-cigarettes made by four companies, including Juul. Can you walk us through the products that you believe this state law is shutting out?
Yeah, so essentially, the 39 products that you referenced, these products have obtained FDA approval, which Wisconsin is piggybacking and basically enforcing the FDA's approval, products that have been approved. And so the only products that Wisconsinites will be able to use are these 39 that happen to be owned by Big Tobacco, RJ Reynolds, Altria. And they're generally products that, you know, customers and do not like to use. They're not effective at helping them quit smoking. And so, you know, the majority of the products that have come out on the market over the past 10 years, they've innovated and effectively helped people quit smoking cigarettes.
So you're saying products like Juul aren't working for your customers, that there are other products that aren't approved by the FDA that are better?
Well, it's hard to say that one is better or not. Like, for example, Juul, the news that Juul's just was approved within the last few days, you know, they have menthol flavored and tobacco flavored, and the parameters that the FDA sets for getting these vapes approved is just unknown. Nobody knows what they're looking for. Companies are spending, I mean, millions of dollars to get the approvals, and millions of applications have been denied, and only a handful have been approved. And it's just fishy that that just the big tobacco companies have been approved. You know, similar products that have been denied that are similar or in line with the big tobacco products.
Your suit claims that the law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. How so?
Well, you know, I should reserve a lot of this probably for our legal team, but I can explain that the 2009 Tobacco Control Act was formed by Congress, and there is a specific way that only the FDA is allowed to regulate and enforce this law. And so by Wisconsin coming in and effectively requiring FDA approval, Wisconsin is becoming the enforcement arm for the FDA, and the FDA's and the federal law exclusively prohibits that. It does not allow for the state to enforce something exclusively reserved for the FDA.
Are vape shops at risk of going out of business under this new state law?
Well, there was about 3,000 businesses that received the letters like I received earlier this year that we're not going to be able to sell most of our products. And so there's 3,000 small businesses in Wisconsin that are that are at risk of going out of business. And myself, I own a shop, and we have many employees that are getting paid livable wages. People that have been with us for over 10 years. And yes, we would have to shut our doors if this law goes into effect on September 1st.
Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Tyler Hall is president of the trade group Wisconsinites for Alternatives to Smoking and Tobacco on why his group filed a suit against the state of Wisconsin over a law banning the sale of vaping products that are not approved by the FDA. Now let's turn to Carrie Arblaster, Midwest Regional Advocacy Director for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. That's a group working to stop youth vaping. Carrie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kate. We appreciate you asking us to be here.
Yes, so this new state law imposing fines on people who make and sell products that are not authorized by the FDA, what have you seen in other states with this kind of ban that just went into effect in Wisconsin?
Yeah, great question. I mean, this is a relatively new policy, and I should note that it's not one that comes from the public health community. Rather, it is one that is coming from the tobacco industry. To date, we've had 14 states pass laws or directory laws. They do vary somewhat, but effectively, only three states are actually implementing them. So, from our perspective, this is not a policy that is having any kind of significant public health impact. And again, it's not something that's coming from public health advocates. And actually, there's much better policies kind of in our toolbox that are more effective at preventing youth use, such as, restricting the sale of flavored tobacco, ensuring that the age of consumption and the age to purchase is properly up at 21, and then, an effective tax rate, right, so that products are appropriately priced and not accessible to youth.
Can we talk just a moment here about this registry concept that, 14 other states besides Wisconsin have similar regulations requiring you to register your vape product with the state that is FDA approved? What impact would a registry like this have on Wisconsin vape shops and on the industry?
Well, I can't really, speak necessarily from the vape shop perspective.
Yeah.
What I do want to highlight, though, and again, I'll just reference back. These are new policies. We don't have a lot of data. We only have three states that have implemented them. In those states, there's not a lot of evidence that this, again, is an effective public health tool. And what I mean by that is it's driving down use and it's deterring youth use. But what I can say, especially when we're talking about e-cigarettes, which predominantly are flavored, they are intentionally designed to appeal to youth, both in the way that they are marketed, in the way that they are sold, and, by the types of flavors that they come in, right? So bubblegum, cotton candy, these are very kid-friendly flavors, things that would attract youth. We really do not see much evidence that e-cigarettes are effective in having or helping adults stop smoking or stop using. There's inconclusive evidence to say that that is actually an effective tool. But what we do know, again, is that the majority of these products are flavored, that they are geared towards kids. And we do know from the 2024 National Youth Tobacco Survey that youth who use e-cigarettes, almost 90% of them are using flavored products, And the fact of the matter is that without youth using and becoming addicted to this product, quite frankly, the industry doesn't exist in the future without that.
And I want to jump in here. The FDA announcing last week that Juul can keep its e-cigarettes on the market. Juul has been blamed for sparking the teen vaping trend. What do you make of this announcement?
Yeah, I mean, for us, we put out a statement from our CEO, and quite frankly, we see it as a big step backward, for preventing youth e-cigarette use. Yes, there are menthol flavored products that have been authorized by the FDA. To date, that is the only flavor that has been authorized. But we know that menthol is something that the industry uses to target youth. We also know that it, you know, makes the process or the using of that product less harsh, and it also can increase the likelihood of really rapid and steep addiction. So, you know, we weren't super happy to see that.
Well, the FDA has been heavily criticized for how it's handled e-cigarettes. What changes do you want to see in the way these products are regulated federally and in states like Wisconsin?
You know, simply put, we want the FDA to enforce the law. You know, there's rules on the books. They're to be enforcing this. There's only, like you said at the beginning of the show, 39 products that are authorized for use and sale in this country, and we would like to see that enforced.
How are teen vaping numbers now? What do you see?
I mean, they're pretty high, you know. So in Wisconsin, it is, let me look here. It's not quite as high as it was, you know, in 2017, which led the U.S. Surgeon General, of course, to declare a youth e-cigarette epidemic. But it still remains much higher than smoking rates. And that's really where the future of this industry is.
Yeah, I mean, because we have seen middle and high school students a pretty steep decline significantly in recent years. And that was from the CDC data from last October. What do you make of that decline?
I mean, that's good. That's the direction we want to go in. But quite frankly, we still have a lot of work to do. And, you know, when the market is flooded with products that are geared towards kids, that's a serious problem. You know, and one thing that we do see is we see younger kids, middle school kids, you know, the rate of initiation in that group increasing. And that is not good. We do not want to see that at all. So we're really happy that these numbers are declining, right? That's what we want to see. But there's still a lot of work to do, you know, and again, I'll point back to the fact that the market is just inundated with those flavored products, you know, that are really geared and marketed towards youth.
Carrie, thank you for your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Carrie Arblaster is Midwest Regional Advocacy Director for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. She talked about this new law in Wisconsin banning the sale of e-cigarettes that are not approved by the FDA. We also spoke with Tyler Hall, president of a vape trade group suing the state over that new law. Coming up, kids are riding bikes less than they used to. Find out how communities can become friendlier and safer for children on bikes. And meet two teens who are training elementary school students.
Working bike camps with the kids and just seeing their joy in their faces when they get on the streets and just start riding safely.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the height of summer and with back to school around the corner, we might expect to see lots of kids out riding their bikes, but they're not doing that as much as they used to. According to data from the National Sporting Goods Association, there's been a big national decline in the number of kids riding bikes. A recent report in The Atlantic finds a number of reasons for that decline, including concerns about safety and communities designed more for drivers than for bikers and walkers. My colleague Rob Ferret recently talked with Wisconsin experts and high school students about bike safety in the state. He starts with Bob Schneider, professor and co-chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I was emailing back and forth with you about this national article saying, hey, there's this decline in kids riding bikes. From where you stand as somebody who watches urban planning and design and safety for pedestrians and bicyclists, what are you thinking when you hear that news?
Yeah, I wish we had better news about that. It's certainly something that we want to see more of, that is kids biking we'd like to see exercise and health benefits, independence, socialization, awareness of community, all those benefits that come from bicycling. But indeed, bicycling has gone down among children over the last 5 decades or so. We have data from really 1969 travel survey that showed about half of kids walked and biked to school. Now we're at about 10% in the latest data. And so we're, as a community and the kids themselves, are missing out on some of these benefits.
What do you see as driving that downward trend in kids biking and even walking to school?
Yeah, researchers really look at trends in biking within the lens of travel behavior. One of the key things is availability and awareness of a type of transportation. After that is convenience and cost, then safety and security, and also enjoyment. So when we think about availability, do families have bikes for kids? Do kids have access to a working bike? You know, we have about 53% of households in the U.S. that own a bike on the latest data, compared to Germany, which has 80% household bike ownership. And in the U.S., 85 or 90% of households own a car. And so bicycling is a little bit disadvantaged in that way. So some of the efforts to get kids access to free bikes or repaired bikes, things that the Bike Fed does, those are really important to increase that availability and make people more aware of biking. When it comes to convenience and cost, some changes that have happened over time are our development patterns across metropolitan regions. There's been more development that's spread out and makes distances to activities for kids, schools, but also other places that they might go farther. And so it's just a little bit less convenient to go by bike if it takes you longer to do that. And so parents will often drive their kids around to various opportunities for activity. I think a really important one that you touched on already is the idea of safety. And we know that bicycle fatality rates in the United States per mile ridden are 3 to 6 times higher than in countries like the UK, Germany, Denmark, the Netherlands. And so I think parents have a sense that roadways, you know, across the country in many communities just feel dangerous because of the cars that are around. And so efforts that communities are doing to develop low stress bike networks, that includes trails and protected bike lanes, neighborhood greenways or bike boulevards, and really lower speed limits through traffic calming measures are all things that are trying to be done to make the streets safer for kids and make parents more comfortable letting their kids out and bike. And I think also important is the aspect of enjoyment. And certainly many people really enjoy biking, especially kids. The activity itself, being out and getting the activity that way, seeing it's good for the environment, good for health. But there's competing technology and other activities for kids' time. Does that type of stimulation through technology replace some of the outdoor activity that kids had gotten in the past, such as bicycling? So all those travel behavior factors may have, you know, played a difference, may have impacted the overall biking levels over time. And some of the strategies that are being done in communities today are trying to reverse that trend.
And I want to talk about the kind of the philosophy of how we design communities and transportation. And there's been and we've talked about this before, Bob, the distinction between, okay, this is a road where the goal is to get cars through as quickly as possible versus this is a street where the goal is to make sure multiple users, cars, pedestrians, bikes, and maybe others can all use it safely together, maybe at the expense of, you know, slowing those cars down a little bit. Do you see us rethinking that, especially in residential areas and areas where there are schools, where we're thinking more, hey, these are streets, not roads?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the core components of Safe Routes to School programs and initiatives. I also think that over time, as more kids get back into bicycling, they will develop more of a consciousness of streets as public space. Streets as places where people walking, people biking are welcome and encouraged, and so that it'll change social attitudes towards that, so that we don't exclusively design for high-speed cars. Instead, have more of an attitude like, yes, if we go a little bit slower in our cars and devote a little bit more space for walking and biking, we will end up creating more benefits for the community as a whole.
And Bob, if there's somebody out there listening saying, hey, I look around my community, I don't feel like it'd be safe for kids to bike here. I would like to change that. But, you know, we're not flush with cash. We don't have a lot of resources to completely overhaul our town. What would you suggest as some economical ways to make a difference and make it, you know, conceivable, make it approachable for kids to bike, at least to school?
For sure. I think there are a number of things that go along with Safer to School programs, but there are bike trains, biking school buses, you may call them, where kids will bike together in groups. That's an opportunity to experience what it's like to ride, but also have the companionship of others. And it adds an extra sense of security when doing that. I think events like Open Streets that have been done really a lot since the pandemic in communities where streets will be closed off to through traffic, but really prioritized for walking and biking, gives a chance for people to experience the street like that in their neighborhood. And those Open Streets locations can rotate around to different places. Some of them can be near schools, especially. One other thing I should say when it comes to traffic calming is that there are things called temporary treatments or rapid implementation projects that a number of communities have tried, simply using flexible posts and paint to show what types of new bike lanes or protected bike lanes could be added, new curb extensions, and they're done at a low cost and can be reversed if they need to be, but it's a good way to experiment and see what that type of new traffic calming can look like.
Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Bob Schneider, professor and co-chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. We're talking about kids, biking, safety, and the way we design our communities. Now we'll turn to the Wisconsin Bike Federation. It advocates for safer routes to and from schools, helps teach kids all over regions around the state how to ride a bike. Michael Anderson is the Milwaukee Youth Program Director at the Wisconsin Bike Federation. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for thinking of the Bike Fed. We're excited to chat with you.
Well, Bob mentioned this idea of safe routes to schools. I know this is something that you work on. What kind of things have you seen work to make communities more bike-friendly for kids going to school?
Yeah, the Wisconsin Bike Fed has been working on safe routes to school efforts in Milwaukee Public Schools for our 20th year now. So we've seen all sorts of strategies and programs work. I want to point out the question of where small towns could start or people with less resources. Bob brought up a really great example of like those active streets, those quick implementation. And we've got a school on Milwaukee's west side called Bethune Academy. It's along a street called Galena that connects two parks, very what should be child-friendly spaces. And in the pandemic, that became what the city called an active street. And we utilized that, getting kids back and forth for camps. Then the neighborhood and the residents became more familiar with us. And that has now led to further investment of actual traffic calming infrastructure a few years later, as well as recently a paint the pavement project where the students themselves were out there making art. And that piece helped the community then to view the infrastructure more as a community asset rather than just another ugly piece of concrete.
And another piece of the puzzle, Michael, that you work on that Bob talked about is access to having bikes and bike repair. When I chatted with you briefly about this topic earlier, you were in the midst of a program. You do a lot of hands-on training with kids on safety and bike maintenance and stuff. What kind of work do you do?
During the school year, our core content is a really intensive two-week bicycle driver's ed program. For fourth through sixth grade, we tend to target. And that's about 1,200 kids in the district a year. My colleague, Anthony, also manages our bike shop at North Division High School, as well as manages his own set of teens who are out with a mobile bike repair unit at different play fields through the summer, and they're fixing up bikes for the community for free. The other thing that Anthony does at North Division is, as bike donations come up, we fix those up there with some of the teens from North Division High School. And then kids that are in our bicycle driver's ed program, we try to prioritize them to receive those bikes. So now we've given kids the tools and the experience that they could actually do that ride themselves.
And Michael, you've got an internship program where you've got students themselves advocating for bikes and safe biking. Tell us a little bit about the internship program.
Yeah. So like I said, we've had 20 years in MPS. Most of that was working explicitly with kindergarten through eighth grade population due to grant functions. And last year, we were able to hire another lovely colleague, Alora Correa, who manages our Active Transportation Academy. It's another Safe Routes program. So she's doing bicycle driver's ed and clubs and training across the district. But in the summertime, she's got four interns from one of our partners just down the street on Galena at the Tiefenhaller Park called the Peak Initiative. And we've got four interns that are with her all summer long, getting exposed to things from walk audits, bike audits we'll be jumping into this coming week. Right now, they're shadowing my team of instructors and helping lead camps for fourth and fifth graders. So that's one of the great experiences that they're having right now as well.
Michael, we're going to turn to those interns now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's meet a couple of those interns. Jaden Simmons-Willis is a 12th grader at Wisconsin Lutheran High School. Jaden, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
And Naomi Murphy is an 11th grader at Milwaukee Lutheran High School. Naomi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I want to ask each of you about your biking careers. Let's start with you, Naomi. When did you start biking, and how much do you bike now to school or elsewhere?
I started biking when I was around 7, when I started getting into it, especially because I lived in a community where it was full of kids. So it was usual for you to see kids biking to the nearest park or just biking around with friends. My biking has decreased because I did move, and where I moved to is more of a bigger intersections around their place, so it's not really the safest place to be biking, but I do bike in the morning to my internships while the traffic is low.
And Jaden, how about you? What does your biking history look like?
I started biking when I was around 5, I'd say. I learned in after I fell off a couple of times, and it stuck with me since then.
And do you bike now when you're going back and forth to school, Jaden?
I say no, because my school is 10 miles from my house, so It would be a long journey to bike.
That is all.
Especially in the winter.
Yeah. Now, can you let's talk about the internship now, Jaden. What kind of work have you done with Bike Fed when it comes to the internship?
We've led bike camps at Carver Academy. And basically what we do is we come in, kids who don't know how to ride a bike, we teach them how to, and try to facilitate them away from the group so they aren't made fun of or embarrassed for not knowing how to ride a bike. For the kids who do know how to ride bikes, we'll typically lead a follow the leader and set up a course for them to ride through to explain safety in the street, and also turn signals and braking. And then we finish up with all the leader so they know what a street ride will look like before we actually go out on the road with them.
And Naomi, can you talk about your work with the internship? What are some of the things you've enjoyed doing?
Some of the stuff I've enjoyed doing during this internship is just working bike camps with the kids and just seeing their joy in their faces when they get on the streets and just start riding safely. And when we get to our destinations, just them having the connections with the other kids around them, just riding their bikes and just seeing the joy on their faces.
I want to ask each of you for one change you'd like to see in your neighborhood or in the roads around the city that would make it safer and easier for kids to bike around. Naomi, let's start with you this time. If you had that magic wand, what is one thing you would want to change?
One thing I would want to change is more protected bike lanes, like a barrier between the street and the bike lane, just to make sure it is safer and no cars could come onto the bike lane why any biker in or cyclist is biking, just to make sure that it's an extra barrier of protection right there.
And Jaden, what's one thing you would want to change to make biking friendlier for kids in the community?
I'd say just bike lanes in general, because there are some areas that don't have bike lanes. And if you choose to ride your bike through there, you would be about like 2 feet away from cars riding past you. So I'd make that change, because some intersections, you can't really go all out with things that will slow down cars or infrastructure.
And finally, if there are people out there, families listening with kids, what would you say to encourage them to give biking a try if they haven't yet? Let's start with you, Jaden, this time. What would you say to those families?
I would say start by using a trail and see how you enjoy riding just in general before you decide to go out into the street. And then if you do make that leap and decide to go out into the street, I'd say learn safety and your turn signals and how to signify that you're braking.
All right. And Naomi, some words of encouragement.
I would just say spread awareness, especially to the child, about the safety when you are cycling. Just to make sure they're aware of their surroundings. And also just make sure, like, it's a fun thing to do, but you also got to make sure you put your protection out there to make sure that your child is safe.
Oh, could I add one thing?
Go for it.
All right. Wear helmets. Helmets are very important.
All right. Jaden, thanks for talking to us today.
No problem.
Naomi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jaden Simmons-Willis and Naomi Murphy. Both are interns at the Wisconsin Bike Federation in Milwaukee, talking with Rob Ferret. Earlier, we heard from Michael Anderson, Youth Program Manager with the Bike Fed, and Bob Schneider, Professor and Co-Chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, the Brewers are racking up wins. Hear from WISN-TV's sports director on why it's about the long view and not about individual wins.
But if you can stockpile some of these series, like win this three game or split this four game or win this three, you're going to be in a really good spot come the end of September.
A Brewers historic season taking shape. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Brewers are having one of the best seasons so far in franchise history. Their 56 wins at the All-Star break set a new team record, and it represented the second-best winning percentage at the break in team history. They shut out the Seattle Mariners last night, making it their 11th win in a row. We're checking in on their success this season, the emergence of star rookie pitcher Jacob Mizorowski, the Miz, as they say in Milwaukee, and what's in store for the rest of the season. Helping us out is Dario Melendez, sports director at WISN-TV in Milwaukee. Dario, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
The Brewers started off the season a little slow out of the gate. How dominant were they heading into the All-Star break?
Well, I mean, a little slow is an understatement. It's hilarious because I used to be on the Brewers broadcast doing their pre and post game show for a number of years. And then I was able to make my move over to WISN 12. And I know this team like the back of my hand. And I could tell you right now, even though people thought they were calm, it was kind of like a duck on the water. They were calm up top at the beginning of the year. They were panicking a little bit below. We actually talked to some of the players as well right before the All-Star break, and they admitted, yeah, we got off to a rough start. We didn't understand it. But then when you kind of take a look back and look at all the injuries they had, I mean, they used, what, 11, 12 different starting pitchers, which if you use that in a full season, it's a lot, let alone the first month and a half of a season. So they were just banged up. I mean, spring training is a grind, and then you get to the beginning of the year and guys are dealing with bumps and bruises, then guys are dealing with bigger injuries, guys that you're expecting to really, you know, contribute and be mainstays on your roster and in your starting rotation. But then you kind of saw when guys started getting healthy, And as soon as you get some of your starting pitchers back and you get some of your key position players back, when late May hit, this became the best team in baseball. And it really just correlates with them just getting healthier.
Hmm. All right. So we went from floundering duck underwater. Now duck is really taking flight. You know, as we talk, they stand just behind the Cubs and the NL Central. Is this a good place to be in the standings at this point?
Oh, it's a great place. Like, look, with the expanded playoff season that went in a couple of years ago, most teams think they're in. So really, all in the postseason push, really all you need to do is be within three, maybe four games of first place heading into the All-Star break, and you're in contention for a playoff spot. So the Brewers, as I mentioned before, with all these injuries and all of these setbacks in the beginning of the year, the fact that they're only one game out of first place and they're currently in the top NL wildcard spot, which gives them a playoff berth as of today, they're in a great position. So Matt Arnold, their GM, who is, in my opinion, one of the best GMs in all of baseball, he won Executive of the Year last year. He's in a great position to go out and see what other players are on the trade market right now. I mean, the Brewers are in a very good position, but they could definitely use some added pieces, maybe a big-time bat. There's a guy out in Arizona, Eugenio Suarez, who would fit perfectly with this team. He plays third base. He has 20-plus home runs already this season. He knows the NL Central because he used to play for the Reds. Pitching, they're pretty much set.
Yeah, it's a little bit of some commotion on the mound. There's a little bit of traffic.
They have so much.
Yeah.
They have so much pitching. And look, this is a great place you want to be if you're the Brewers to have this plethora of pitching. So then the question is, do you start mortgaging some of that extra pitching you had for some of these bats?
Well, you know, I think MLB lays it out, you know, ahead of this trade deadline, saying that Milwaukee has the eighth fewest home runs in the majors, and the left side of its infield in particular has been a black hole. And I'm like, ouch, you know. So how do the Brewers get some hitting here and get some pop?
Well, that's where I think that Eugenio Suarez or a guy like Alex Bregman as well, who's on the trading block, both of them play third base, so that's the left side of your infield. Matt Arnold and Pat Murphy went into the season saying, like, hey, we have Joey Ortiz, who was a converted shortstop to play third base last year. We're just going to move him back to shortstop, and then we'll figure out third base. And look, they traded for Durbin, who has been very good this year. He's come up with some big hits. He was part of the Devin Williams trade, but he's not the guy, in my opinion, that's going to get you a World Series title. He's a guy that could help get you to the postseason. He's been great in the clubhouse. They've had another couple of guys that they've tried to plug in place. But if you can get someone like an Eugenio Suarez or an Alex Bregman, who have a lot of power and can play a very good defensive third base, it takes the Brewers from the postseason contenders to a championship contender in one move.
How are you feeling about Christian Yelich these days as designated hitter?
He looks great. I mean, again, I was back here in 18 when the Brewers traded for him, and he won the NL MVP, and then 2019 he's on his way to another MVP and then breaks his knee. And I don't think people realize how long it kind of takes for someone to come back after a knee injury like that, especially when you have COVID and you can't really kind of test out in 2020. And then you have some back issues, because anybody who's ever had an injury knows that once you injure one part of your body, another part of your body is going to try to, you know, catch up and pick up the slack. And I guarantee that was his back. So he's feeling better now, and he is leading by example. Christian Yelich isn't a big rah-rah guy, but he's a big put your nose down, get in the ballpark, get to work, and watch me and do as I do.
Which is what they need right now. They've got all these rookies.
100%.
Do they need a leader out there for these rookies with, you know, Yelich in his 13th, I think, major league season? Mm-hmm. Has he really become that role as helping these young players really find their stride here?
He's definitely taken a little bit more of the mentor role, especially with Willy Adames leaving and going over to San Francisco. Willy Adames was such a huge presence in that clubhouse. So the big concern that I had going into this year was, well, who's going to be that guy for the Brewers now? Freddie Peralta's done a great job stepping up and being the leader, and so is Christian Yelich. Again, it's not his comfort zone to be the rah-rah outspoken guy, but he has definitely taken that veteran mentorship role, especially with some of the younger players that this team has. And he's done a really good job just connecting with them, because I think he sees it. Like, look, he's been in the league for over a decade now. At some point, he needed to be that, come to me, come talk to me, let me show you what Major League Baseball is about, and do as I do in my training routine. And he's done that.
We have WISN TV sports director Dario Melendez. As we take a look at the Milwaukee Brewers at this point in the season, so strong, and we're going to talk here about the emergence of the Miz, the rookie pitcher.
Man.
Yeah, Jacob Mizorowski. Yes.
Yep.
So what are you seeing here? I mean, he got 25, or, you know, he's got this, what is it, 102 mile per hour fastball, 103 mile per hour. What's going on with this and the rise?
It's been crazy. I talk about Matt Arnold and what a great job he's done, but he has surrounded himself with some of the best scouts, coaches, analytic guys. They have this pitching lab out in Arizona where their spring training takes place, and they've just been able to kind of pick these guys out of nowhere. Like Jacob Mizorowski came from a small junior college out in Missouri. He's 120 pounds soaking wet out of the shower. He's taller than anything, but man, they have figured out a way to harness his leverage that his lanky body can kind of generate and just throw 100 plus mile an hour almost every pitch. His slider comes in, which again, a slider is kind of your change of pace pitch for those who don't know. And a slider usually is in maybe the high 80s. If you throw really hard, low 90s, he throws his 97. Like there are, I would say most of Major League Baseball, their fastballs don't hit 97. So he's 6'7", 6'8". And by the time he throws the ball, he's already closer to you than most pitchers because he's just so long. and he's a good kid. And this is the kind of the prospect that everybody's had their eye on, which is why if you're Matt Arnold, you have no problem trading a Corbin Burns. You have no problem letting go of a Brandon Woodruff and bringing him back, because you kind of know that you have these guys waiting in the wings. And there's other guys down in AAA and AA right now that are going to be, I don't know if they're going to be on Mizorowski's level, but they're going to be very good starting pitchers in baseball. And he has kind of lived up to all the hype. He had one bad outing in New York against the Mets, but he has been so good, and he's been so humble. He's a dork. Like, he plays Dragon Ball Z. He plays Dungeons and Dragons, like, in his locker before games.
And the fans love him. I
think that's what they like. He's kind of Milwaukee. Look, Milwaukee's a little weird. Like, we're a little goofy, which is great. Like, we don't have to be, you know, the big brother that thinks they're so cool. Like, we know who we are. Like, the Brewers know who they are. The Brewers know Brewer baseball is good defense, great pitching.
Yeah.
You get some hitting in there, that's awesome. But like they're a hard-nosed team, kind of like their manager. You pitch well, you play good defense, good things are going to happen. And then that's what the Brewers have been doing.
And I love how Pat Murphy says, look, people want to see the Miz pitch. It's an entertainment business. And I really think that gets at the heart of that type of philosophy for Pat Murphy, is that, you know, people want this fun. They want some energy out there, and they want some excitement. And this kid is bringing it.
Yeah, look, five starts into your major league career and you're an all-star. That's never happened before. It's the fastest ascension from debut to all-star in baseball history. The funny part is last year was the previous fastest, and that was Paul Skeens with the Pirates, also a flame-throwing pitcher, and he was 11 games. There were two things that got Miz the all-star game. One, no one else wanted to go. They asked 12, 13, 14, 15 other pitchers. They're like, nah, we're good.
We're going to take a break.
Now, look, MLB season's long. I get it.
Yeah.
But then Mizorowski gets in, and of course he's going to say yes, because he's a young guy that just came up.
Yeah.
100. Yeah, he just wants to play.
Great.
And there was some blowback. I get it. But Murphy was right to defend this guy. And so was Christian Yelich. Christian Yelich was like, look, I get why people don't want him there. He's only played in the MLB for five games. It's supposed to be this really emotional experience, you know, going to your first All-Star game. But at the same time, if you don't like it, explicit of you. I don't care. Like, and if we're being honest, like, Mizorowski's been in Major League Baseball for about a month. He might be the best pitcher in baseball over that month. So if it's an all-star game that's supposed to be showcasing the best of the best, I think a lot of people can make the case for Jacob Mizrowski being the best pitcher in baseball during his brief time in baseball.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to look ahead here and not jinx ourselves. What do you see as the biggest key for the Brewers to make some real noise here as we head down the stretch and perhaps in the postseason? What's going to go on?
So the philosophy that the Brewers have always had is we're not going to break the bank right now and mortgage our future away to make a big push. Like right now, they're set up to be a postseason contender for the next several years. And if you look at year after year after year, the best team doesn't usually win the World Series. It's the hottest team. So Matt Arnold's philosophy is like, you know what? Let's play some really good baseball. Let's get to the postseason and see what happens. In 18, things went really well.
Yeah.
Since then, they get to the postseason and it's one and done. I could see Matt Arnold taking a big time swing, getting one of those bats we talk like a Bregman or a Suarez, and seeing where you can go from there. But the biggest thing the Brewers are going to have to do is just keep stockpiling wins. And I know that sounds obvious, right? Like, oh, win games. They have like the 10th hardest schedule coming into the second half, where the Cubs have a much easier schedule in the second half. So it's playing your brand of baseball, which is good defense, good pitching. When you play the Cubs, which I believe they have two series against the Cubs coming up in the final half, you have to win those series. You have to win the head-to-head. You can't let the Cubs put distance between you, because those head-to-head against the team that's ahead of you, are they almost count as two games, because you get a game and then you drop them a game.
Well, you know, what you say there reminds me of the second baseman Bryce Turing saying winning is the most important thing. Everything's about winning. And I'm just wondering, I wonder if that sentiment is more widely shared among the players at this point.
Yeah, Murphy does a really good job of kind of instilling that in his guys. Like, if we're being honest, players don't care about wins or losses in May, June, earlier in the year. They don't care. Like, you can make up a loss. This is where wins kind of start to become more important.
Yeah.
Because it's a long season. It's 162 games plus, spring training. So once you get out of the All-Star break, it is full tilt for September and August. August and September, I apologize. And this is where wins really become important. So yes, it's not looking ahead to, I understand, we want to look ahead to the Cubs series, which is coming up soon, but you have the Dodgers right out of the gate.
Yeah.
You just swept them. If you can figure out how to get two wins in LA, that's a win. And look, you don't have to win every game, but if you can win almost every series from now until the end of the season, you're going to be in really, really good shape. That's what the 18 Brewers did. That's pretty much what the 19 Brewers did. It's not as much about every game. It's about every series, because it's hard to ask to sweep every time, right? I mean, you can't just win 15, 13, 20 games in a row. But if you can stockpile some of these series, like win this three gamer, split this four gamer, win this three, win this three, win this three, you're going to be in a really good spot come the end of September.
Well, Dario, appreciate the analysis. Thank you so much for the conversation. Go Brewers.
Anytime.
Dario Melendez is the sports director at WISN-TV in Milwaukee with us to discuss the Milwaukee Brewers' hot streak and expectations for the second half of the season as the Brew Crew now tops the NL Central. Wisconsin Insect Fest is just around the corner at Ulbricht Botanical Gardens in Madison, and we're talking with one of the presenters tomorrow who studies a family of beetles that live in swampy areas. The PowerPoint is called Sex, Violence, and Deception, The Hidden World of Wetland Insects. I know, I caught our attention too. So to get us ready to talk about this aspect of the insect world, we want to know about your run-ins with fireflies in these summer evenings and whether you've been dealing with mosquitoes where you are. Give us your take on insects in your community. What's biting, what's not? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Colleen Leahy, Avery Lee Rogers, and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.